Blog Talk Radio. This podcast is brought to you by the Phantom Gallery Chicago Network, an artist-run project that exhibits in non-traditional gallery settings. The Phantom Gallery looks at how the city influences art and how artists transform the city by contributing to civic dialogue and quality of life. These installations produce creative conversations. I'm your host, Alpha Bhutan. Thank you for listening. Hi, good afternoon. Today we have Katina Robinson Hale on the line, and she's going to talk about And the Walls Came Tumbling Down. Hi, Katina.
Hi, Alpha. Thank you for having me today.
Yeah, I'm glad you're able to schedule us in your busy schedule. First of all, I want you to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you're up to, what you're doing, and a little bit of your past.
Okay.
As an artist.
Hello, everyone. I'm Katina Robinson Hale. I've been a Chicago Public School art teacher for high school level for the last 17 years. I've been off and on practicing my own artwork outside of teaching. Currently, my installation that's up right now, And the Walls Come Tumbling Down, kind of takes me back to when I was in college, just trying to capture things that were happening around me. I've never been able to show my photos of the project coming down, and this is a very exciting time for me. Other projects have been multimedia projects. I liked abstract oil painting and photography and collaging. So, yes, I have a BFA for art education from UIC, and just all of my education has kind of been towards art teaching. So that's where I am right now.
And you also are a wife, mother.
You have
a family.
I do have a family. Outside of my school family, you know, it's like a second job when I come home. I currently have two teenagers and a loving husband. So me practicing my craft is a little seldom at the moment. You know, I haven't mastered the timing of professional teaching career, teaching artist, parents, wife, all of that. I still haven't blocked out that time in my life to actually create as much as I would love to. The instances in which I've had a chance to get away would be more so like an art camp for a week away from everything, then I'm able to concentrate and actually produce some palatable work. Yes.
Well, you know, as an art educator, I think that, you know, we get into the trenches of, you know, sharing our creativity and molding and shaping the young people so they have, you know, a sense of art appreciation. So you're doing your craft, you know, and doing what you're professionally trained to do. So, and with that, I applaud you, because a lot of us, we get into our later years and then focus on our art and not able to work. You know, I have some stories of other professional artists that work for the Board of Ed, and they supplemented their art practice, but they waited until they retired out before they could actually, you know, get into their art practice. So, you know, it's a balancing act that we do with our professions. So I wanted to kind of circle and around and talk about your installation. And I saw you came out to the project that we're doing at the Overton Hygienic Building, which is an historical landmark here in Chicago. And the installation is called Art and Social Justice, Examining the State of Our Environment. And you were there during the Black Men Missing and Missing Black Men Artist Talk with Tashaun Werner and Larissa Johnson and Tushant. Well, I said his name already, but Paula Robinson, who is a curator for that show, and you were there in the audience, and you know, at the end of the talk, you came to me and said, oh, this would be perfect for me to install photographs. And so, and I really love that type of energy when a space kind of activates someone else's creativity. And Katina came in and, you know, the day we scheduled and was able to install her piece. So, you know, I know you kind of briefly talked about it, but if you want to come into some more detail, you know, about your installation.
Yes. So, and the walls came tumbling down. It's a visual piece that highlights some photos that I took while some of the Chicagoland area housing projects were being torn down. So I was currently, while I took those pictures, I was finishing up at UIC. You know, I was never one of those art students that literally walked around with their camera every day. I never got comfortable with that. But for some reason, I felt inside like these things, these homes of generations of African Americans are just being torn down, you know, of people are being displaced. People that have lived in the city all their lives are being pushed to the suburbs. And while I was thinking this, you know, I took my camera. It probably wasn't smart of me to enter into some abandoned buildings that were on their way of being knocked down, but I wasn't thinking that way. I just thought I want to get a sense of what life was here before these people, before these families were forced out. And so I have a collection of photographs that capture the interiors of these apartments that have been abandoned. Not in the show directly this time, but I'm just thinking of the photos that I have. You know, I wonder what timeline were families given? Because in some apartments, there was food in the cabinets, in the cupboards. There were still canned foods and things. There were dolls, children's toys laying on the ground, and pictures of our late Mayor Harold Washington still on the wall, you know, deflated balloons posted from someone's anniversary and birthday. So it was really, just me wanting to get an understanding of what it was like to just have your home taken away from you. Like, what instance were you given? And so that was part of my installation. That's part of the pictures that are on display. Another section of pictures that are in the installation, kind of over by UIC, that's where, like I said, I went to school. I saw the projects coming down that were across the street from St. Ignatius. And so some of the pictures highlight the exterior, just the crumbling, literal bulldozing of these buildings and just the exposure of these cinder block apartments. And I found it beautiful and heart-wrenching at the same time just to see, you know, these individual colors that these families had in their cinder block homes or apartments, just putting it up against the pristine image of St. Ignatius in the background. I talk about how just the idea of something like the Catholic Church is being highlighted in the background and as being, you know, a part of people's lives that are cherished and, you know, money put into them. But then right behind it, you have families, generation of families in their homes are being torn apart. And so I like the juxtaposition of the two imagery, the crumbling buildings with the St. Ignatius bell tower in the background. I think it gives you a sense of kind of destruction, not really a sense of hope, even though the church is supposed to represent hope. But in the end, I think it kind of tells a story of the tale of two cities that, you know, is easily tossed around when you're familiar with how Chicago is separated, how races are separated, and just one street of Roosevelt separating these projects from the St. Ignatius School and the church, how on one side of Roosevelt everything is pristine and kept and beautiful, and then on the other side that the African Americans are at, things are literally just being torn apart, your home being torn down, the history that you had there with your families, the generation of families that happened to be in those homes just being dislocated, just kind of losing their homes. And so that's kind of
Well, it's kind of interesting because I've gone down Roosevelt Road and I attend, church at Life Changes International, and they've bought up a huge block of, for the sanctuary. And then as I walk that way, when I get off Roosevelt down, Blue Island, all that has been redeveloped. And a lot of single-level townhouses and affordable housing has been rebuilt in those places where those projects were torn down. So in the sense of displacement, in order to bring renewal to those areas, that conversation goes wavers back and forth, but I do see the new growth and the new development that has happened in that area in the last 10 years. Since you've taken these images, and then I was over there when I was working with the Chicago Public Art Group where I met you, we were having conversations with, some of the resident committees over there because we were trying to put programming in there, and there was a lot of money coming in for public art type projects with the money for the redevelopment, So I was over there on those panel discussions before they tore down those project housing and, but then to see even where we are at the Overton building on 35th and State Street, all of that area were high-rise project housing. And then by IIT and going back south, now you see the new development. And it took like a decade of the land and the lots and the spaces to be kind of dormant, if not longer, because you said you took these photographs in 1996?
Yeah.
That's almost 20 years. That's almost like a 20-year time span, and a lot of those lots are still empty, and they haven't really been renewed or redeveloped, So it's kind of interesting narrative, and I'm really glad you were able to catch the images and archive that. So here it says in your narrative you talk about lockdown in these virtual towers in black areas of the city for many decades. What do you mean by the locks? Because you use the locks as symbolism in your installation.
Yes. I was trying to tie together kind of two themes. I kind of think there's many metaphors for when you see images of a lock and a chain. Whoever you speak with, or when I've shown those couple of pictures in the past, I would listen to conversations of the observer, and everyone kind of had their own interpretation of what the lock and the chain meant for them. For this installation piece in particular, when I did a little bit of background research on the housing developments, on public housing, they spoke about how there are different projects being made in different areas of the city. And in 1937 is when the Chicago Housing Authority began to have four major projects that were going on. And three of the projects were spread out kind of on the north side, a little bit north. There are three projects, and only one of those projects were designated for black families. And the idea of the lock, and the chain is that many of the project homes that were developed were more so 3- and 4-story buildings for residents, for poor families, and those were for the white residents. But then when it came to the first project for black families, they were just following a protocol where they're saying these buildings needed to be erected in areas that reflected the people that were living in them. So out of the four buildings that were being built or areas, only one became a high-rise building, and that was for the African American families. And so what ended up happening is that these concentrated areas, they kept building these high-rise buildings in the African-American communities. So these towers on these parcels of land were for African-American communities, while the other ones functioning as more like townhomes or low-end houses. My metaphor of using the lots and chains is the idea that public housing is supposed to be temporary housing for the most part. But as we know, when, you know, the Black family's been torn apart by, you know, the male being in jail or something of that nature, or being segregated against and can't get this job to support his family, those families are then stuck in that public housing. They're not able to move out of it. So that became a thing. Like, society as a whole, the way things work in America, the way that things worked in the city, is that while Black people are being deprived of just other opportunities, they were kind of on lockdown in these buildings that they resided in. And so I hope I'm answering that question.
You are answering it, but I was also thinking as you're talking, it became generational, where you not only had that one generation that went in, but you had, like, the, you know, 25 years later, the grandmother, you know, still in it, there from and raising another family in there. And so when you're talking about temporary housing as a way to, you know, excel and accelerate and move out and, you know, move into neighborhoods, that's just something that didn't happen. That was like a fail of the public housing, not only here in Chicago, but that was nationally.
They use those words, too, when they describe when they finally decided that, you know, well, these neighborhoods aren't working. They used failed housing systems. Like, they knew that, you know, these towers, multiple towers taking up acres of land in the ghetto, as they say, soon they thought as failed housing projects. Like, they failed. They're not functioning anymore. They're causing problems within the environment of just, you know, whether it's crime or whether it's drugs. So they saw it as a problem. And that is when in 96 and 97, they're like, these failed buildings, we need to do something about them. And so that's when they decided that, you know, pretty much we're going to have to take these buildings down. And the lock and chain part kind of comes in. I spoke of this in my statement. It's funny how they let generations and generations occupy this space. Right. And then all of a sudden, the locks are being opened, but it's not by the residents that are there. It's by the city or the government or the whatever, whoever really owns the land, then deciding, well, these are failed. We want the land for the most part. So then there, the chain is released. Right. The lock is unlocked for you. But that's not really the case. It was just more so displacement. Right. Displacement and separating communities, tearing neighborhoods apart, causing problems in other neighborhoods. So that was kind of the symbolism of the lock and chains, where we were on lockdown in these towers until the government decided, okay, we're going to unlock them now, but for the sole purpose of getting that land back.
So that was the next question I was going to ask you. And basically we're tackling this particular question, and is, what are some of the ways we as artists examine the state of our environment? And what is the intersection of art and social justice as seen in, you know, the practice of curators? And I don't use the term loosely when I talk about curatorial practice, but because what you're doing in your photography is part, when you came into the space, I allowed you to be the curator of your space, of the installation that you were doing. So when I talk in terms of curatorial practice, we've discussed that. And this is just a segment of your practice where you connect the photograph and the imagery and your concept with the installation. So I guess the question is, how does that, or what is the intersection of art and social justice?
In my practice, I was just going to say in general,
I think that the intersection of art and social justice almost right now is like hand in hand. I feel like a lot of the protests that go on for just racial injustices are always accompanied by pieces of artwork. Like, if you can't say it verbally, it is very easy to get your point across visually. And so I feel like current day that art that is focused around issues of social justice is, it would be generic to say that it's popular, but I think that it's just needed right now. It's the type of art that's needed. It's the artists that are living now. It's like we're looking in a history book, and then those artists that were doing artwork to exhibit what was going on in the 60s and the 70s, I feel like there's a reemergence of those type of artists currently. Like, there's issues that need to be out there in the open, and you're getting your point across with your art. And that was in general. For myself, I don't know. I would have never thought of my artwork as being a piece to highlight injustices or be on the topic of social justice. So when I walked into that gallery space just a couple of weeks ago, and, you know, the broad theme of everything was kind of the idea of social justice, I just had, when given that opportunity to show some work, I had to think, well, what do I have that could fit this theme? And I realized that, yes, you know, I've never, ever been able to show my photographs of the projects that I had taken decades ago, like never, ever. And so I really felt as though it just fit perfectly with what was going on within the space. The rawness of the space, the idea that even that particular building, which is a landmark that we're showing in, is susceptible to possibly being knocked down or at least sold, right? So,
well, it was debated, it was saved, and now it's on historic list. The owners of the building are the Davis Group, and they've let the Phantom Gallery, they're basically co-sponsoring us to be there, by letting us have the space in the interim of it being leased out to another government agency or whoever's going to occupy that space. So, they saved it, and they're repurposing it, and it actually offices on the second and third levels. You were going to say?
No, so I was just really trying to find on my own within the works that I have on my own, like what would fit this theme. And I'm just very pleased that the rawness of the space kind of fits the, I see those photographs of even the buildings coming down as kind of poetic and beautiful in a sense anyway, by just the natural colors that were inside each unit being laid out in like gridlock. The juxtaposition, like I said before, of the St. Ignatius Bell Tower behind it, it's just kind of, it's beautiful to me, and I'm just pleased that I've had an opportunity to showcase a few of those photos.
So you probably answered and asked and answered this already, but what does it mean to exhibit in temporary installation spaces outside the museum or gallery? By you walking in here, you know, and seeing that.
Well, for me, a museum, I would never see that. I would never think of myself as becoming that artist that would actually have my work presented in the museum setting. Gallery spaces, I mean, for it to be a gallery space in an art district, again, if not being able to focus my entire life on my practice, I again would not really be able to see myself in the traditional setting of a gallery space. So to have this kind of non-conventional, kind of raw space and opportunity, I feel like this is the perfect opportunity for me. And it doesn't matter so much what my status is in the global art world, because I don't have any status in the global art world. So it's really an opportunity for me to get a message across that may not have ever been, that opportunity may have never come up, right? And so these images that I have, and I have plenty more, they're like a discussion around these pictures that I've had for decades and have never been viewed by anyone but myself. And as much as I like to think that, you know, I captured something, you know, if there's, sometimes there's this need to be affirmed by at least other viewers for them to say, okay, yeah, you did capture something. You know, you caught some history that isn't there anymore. You caught something that these people aren't going to be able to see because it just doesn't exist anymore. So I feel that the temporary art space is a great opportunity for many artists that are not prestigious as you may need to be in a different setting.
Right. And I think that sometimes that the trend for, you know, phantom galleries, you know, and for my own phantom gallery, it's my curatorial practice. And I just feel like that, again, it's, I'm going to talk to you about tactical urbanism, but I've always felt that the need for experimental art and the practice of that is very important. And it's a certain niche of people that can really fit into that and do really well in those spaces, you know, because our job now, because of audience development and how cold it is in Chicago, that people going by that building, there's a presence of people because it's near a train, it's near the CTA, it's near a bus route, it's where people walk past, children walk past, and then they are able to look in to the building. So it's getting its exposure, may not get the audience because it's a pop-up and, you know, you have certain hours that we sit in and certain public activations that occur. And the next activation that will happen in there, a public engagement that will happen in there, will be on Friday, November 30th, and then we will be deinstalling and looking at 2019 for the conversation to continue. But so it is getting, again, an audience. It is getting viewed when the lights are on and people walk by and they happen to look in and they investigate and developers come through the room, architects come through the room, and then the few people that have, you know, come in and documented what we're doing are seeing it. So I think that last question I'm going to talk to you about, we briefly discussed it, but, you know, in terms of tactical urbanism, and I wanted to ask you, you know, it's a phrase I've coined, but I'd like for you to express how you feel about tactical urbanism and where it fits into your practice.
In a sense, you know, when an African-American artist would like to produce some artwork and show their artwork, there's a lot of times where you're being pigeonholed as an African-American to have only express an African-American experience, like the Black experience. So I think tactical urbanism definitely broadens that stage where we're not being pinholed, but we're actually able, maybe we're not even realizing it, but we're able to discuss topics that are important to us at the moment or that are currently happening, and not so much so that it's in the history books or it's what you should be doing or you can't really show any work unless it's Black themed because you're a Black person. I really think that this way of looking at a way of presenting art opens it up a little more. It frees us up a little bit more. The different work that's actually in the space right now, everyone had their own approach and their own story to tell. And it's nice that you're not, you know, the theme is there, but not giving that.
This podcast is brought to you by the Phantom Gallery Chicago
Thank you,
Network,
Katina.
An artist-run project that exhibits in non-traditional gallery settings. The Phantom Gallery looks at how the city influences art and how artists transform the city by contributing to civic dialogue and quality of life. These installations produce creative conversations. I'm your host, Alpha Bhutan. Thank you for listening.